Okay, good morning, Rabbosei. As always, we welcome everyone to our Sunday morning shiur. The topic of today's shiur is based loosely on something which came up in the parsha yesterday, and that is we have here on the sheets, on the first page. So the Torah tells us in the very famous incident that took place when Lavan switched Leah for Rachel. And it says in the pasuk that this is despite the fact that Yaakov Avinu had specifically negotiated with Lavan to make sure that no trickery took place. He said that I will work for Rachel, bitcha ktana, for your daughter Rachel, and he did everything in his power to assure that would work out. Nevertheless, the Torah tells us here in pasuk lafei vayihiva boker. I guess the fourth line from the top, Vayiva Boker, and it was in the morning, Vihine Hileya, and behold it was Leia, Vayomer Lavan. So Yaakov Avinu said to Lavan, Mazos Asisali, what have you done to me? Halo Birachel Avadati Imach Valomerimisani. I worked for Rachel, why have you done this to me? So the Torah continues, Vayomer Lavan. So Lavan responded and said, Lo Yeyose Kein Bimkomenu, that it is not done this way in our place, in this town, it is not done in the manner Loses Hatzeira Lufnei Habechira, to give over a younger child for marriage before an older child. And since Leah is older, so therefore therefore she is the one that you should marry. So the Mefarshim here question the fact that what kind of answer is that? I mean, this was all discussed in advance, meaning that Yaakov had said to Lavan specifically that I am working for Rachel. So, you know, he could say, all of a sudden he comes in that we don't do this. Well, you know, where were you last week when we negotiated this? So the Mefarshim say, it's brought in the Orachayim's commentary and also Sefarno, say that essentially what Lavan was saying was that they won't let me. The people in the town won't allow this because we have such a strong minhag. We have such a strong practice here that despite my interest in doing this, but the community is against it. It's against the community minhag, and therefore I can't do it. So whatever we negotiated. I'm sorry, I was overturned by the interest of the public. So thus we have the first place in the Torah that we find such a concept of minhag hamakom. Okay, now of course, you know, you could say that, well, you know, who cares what Lavan said, but we know that in the halacha, minhag plays a very, very great role. And, this is, I believe, you know, the first place that you see it mentioned in the Chumash. So this was Lavan's taina, it's not our minhag. So, as far, the topic of the shir, therefore, for today is, you know, how do we handle with minhagim, especially in a situation where you have a marriage of two people from different backgrounds. Okay, this is a topic which has become much more relevant in our times than it ever was before because of the fact that with the modern technology, with the ability to travel and the ability of people to connect even from great distances, and with the fact that communities due to, the Holocaust had a tremendous impact on Klal Yisrael in the sense that a lot of communities were destroyed. The whole idea of a kehila is really not so strong anymore. Very rarely do you find a community where there is one strong minhag to do a certain way. Perhaps you have that in Washington Heights in New York with the German community where they still have such a thing. But in a lot of places, you walk into shuls and you see Ashkenazim and Sephardim and Hasidim and Misnagdim and even amongst European people. You know, I remember years ago davening in a shul with Shtibu in New York where they had the Polish table and they had the Hungarish table. The Polish Jews sat on one table and the Hungarian Jews sat at a different table and this one sat at this table. So today there's a great deal of, in that sense, a great deal of Jewish assimilation amongst Frum people. So today you have a lot more, for all of these reasons, you have a lot more what we would call loosely mixed marriages going on in Klal Yisrael, right? It used to be that a person came to marriageable age, so he looked for a shidduch in the town. Who was in the town? You know, the young men and the young women in the town, and maybe, you know, need be, you would go to the next town. But rarely, it was not a common occurrence that a person would go a great distance, and it was even less of an occurrence that a person would go abroad. find someone from a different country, that already was very, very rare. And as such, we don't really find, you would think that on a topic like this, you would find a lot of discussion amongst the poskim from way, way back. But in the Svarim of the Rishonim, there are only really two tshuvas that are found in that discuss this, and even subsequently until our times. In recent times, in the contemporary poskim, there's a lot of discussion, a great deal of writing that's taken place on this topic. But this is the idea of minhag, and how it affects in a marriage situation, a husband and a wife, whose minhagim do you take, and whose minhag do you take both? Okay, today sometimes it's negotiated in advance, where the one side says to the other, and by the way, I'll just take the opportunity to acknowledge that we have Baruch Hashem Achasin, Aaron Yosef Harkavy, sitting here with his future father-in-law. I believe they both have the same minhagim, more or less, but they will soon find out. But the fact of the matter is that this is a discussion, you know, and it could affect any number of things. It could affect, I know myself, in my own family, my father came from a Chassidish family, my mother came from a Misnagdisha family, and even my mother, my mother's father was a Rav in Russia, and my mother's mother was the daughter of a Chassidish family, so there were a lot of these type of stuff that went on in, you know, all kinds of discussions. Are you going to eat gebrucht on Pesach? Are you going to eat kidneys on Pesach? Are you going to give your child an upsharon? Are you going to send, how are you going to teach your child to pronounce the words? Okay, is it going to be O, I, A, E, any other way it could be? Right, I don't want to leave out the Sephardim, you'll tell me what
yes happened. To all those answers.
Yes to all those answers, right? So we all know, a lot of discussion comes up in this area. So first and foremost, it would just be kedai to look into a Gemara, which really tells us how strong minhagim go. We have here the main discussion of minhagim in the Shas is found in the Gemara in the beginning of the fifth parak of Maseches Pesachim, which is entitled Makom Shenagu, and we'll soon see the discussion there centers around the practice on Erev Pesach. We know that on Erev Pesach, so it's not so well, not as well known as it should be, but basically there is a halach on Erev Pesach that after Chatzos, after noon on Erev Pesach, even a person is not supposed to do malacha. It's already considered a semi-yontif, and the reason for that is because in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, that's when the Karban Pesach was brought, and therefore it was already had the status of a yontif. So this is maybe the topic for a different shiur when it gets closer to Pesach, what a person could do and not do on Erev Pesach after Chatzos. But the Gemara tells us, the Mishnah tells us that there were places that had the practice of even not doing malacha before Chatzos on Erev Pesach, meaning that the entire day they didn't do it. And the Mishnah there, which we will get to, discusses what happens if a person travels from one city to another city, and in his city they did malacha, and there they don't, or vice versa. But anyway, that's this. If one wants to research this in the Shas, that would be the main place to look. The beginning of the fifth parak of Pesachim is where this comes up. The Daf Yomi covered it not that long ago. This is the source of the sugya. So we find here, it's on the sheet, the Gemara in Pesachim tells us on Daf Nun Amud Beis, from the top line, the Gemara says, B'nei Baishan Nohod D'lo Havei Ozlan Mitzor L'tzidon B'male Shabbata. That the custom of the Jews, it was the Jewish community in Baishan, and they did not travel from Tzur to Tzidon on Erev Shabbos. Now Rashi tells us that in the city of Tzidon, which is Sidon, I believe is in today considered in Lebanon or whatever that's called now, right? There is such a place, and the Jews did not travel in the city of Tzidon, there was the practice, the custom was that the big market day was Friday. So as such, you know, people were interested in going to purchase all kinds of items there. So the B'nai Baishan took upon themselves the practice that they would not travel on Friday to this market. Why not? Because of the fact that they were afraid that since it was Friday, it would interfere with their preparations for Shabbos. So even though it seems that one was able to make the round trip and still be back in time to, if it wasn't such a great distance, and you were able to make it and back for Shabbos. But they felt that it's going to interfere with their preparation for Shabbos, and they took upon themselves this practice that they're not going to travel. They're not going to travel on Friday. So the Gemara says that this practice went on for quite some time, until it got to the next generation. So Asu Benayu Kamed Rabbi Yochanan. So the second generation, the children of the original Bnei Baishan, came to Rav Yochanan, who was the great halachic authority in Eretz Yisrael. Amru lo, they said to him, Avoson efshaluhu, anan lo efshaluhu. They said, you know, we would like to break with this practice. Because the reason why our parents were able to do this was because of the fact that they were in a much better financial situation. They were wealthy. So therefore they could pass up the opportunity to get a good deal. So, in honor of Shabbos, it wasn't such a big issue for them. But we, who are not wealthy, so by us the money is tight, and we'd like to be able to take advantage of these deals, of the good opportunities to go, right? In other words, this was a special thing. On Friday, right? We have some coming up, Black Friday, right? So you think it was an original idea. Apparently in the city of Tzidon, they had this idea thousands of years ago. So they said to Rabbi Yochanan that we're not going to, that we'd like to break the minute. Amar Luhu, so Rabbi Yochanan said to them, Kvar kiblu avoseichem aleihem. He said, you can't do it. You cannot do it. Why not? Because your forefathers already, your parents already have accepted this. And they've accepted it when they started this practice. They didn't just start it for themselves, but they had the idea that it should go, that this should be the stam practice, this should be the ordinary mode of behavior. And we have a pasuk, shenema shma b'ni musar avicha va'al titosh toras imecha. Okay, that a person, shma b'ni musar avicha, that a person should listen to the strong teachings, the musar of his father, va'al titosh, and do not forsake toras imecha. The Torah of your mother. What does it mean? Al titosh taras imecha. What's the difference between that and Musar Avicha? So the way the Chazal interpret the pasuk in Mishlei is that Musar Avicha refers to the concrete halachas that we find in the Torah, that we find in the Torah and in the Gemara. And Al titosh taras imecha, the second half of the pasuk, is a reference to minhagim. It's a reference to customs. That's Taras Imecha. Now, Musar Avicha is what comes from Hashem. You know, Taras Imecha is what came from the Klal Yisrael. In other words, it was internally generated in the Klal Yisrael, certain practices over the generations. Al Titosh, do not forsake them. So therefore, Rabbi Yochanan said that despite the fact that they needed the money, despite the fact that this was an opportunity for them to go ahead and good business, but nevertheless, you cannot do it. Al titosh taras imecha. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. What's your opinion on a girl who has been waiting 6 hours after?
We'll get there. We're going to get to that. We'll soon get to that. Not soon. We'll get to that. Yeah. In other words, from this Gemara Rabbosai, we see the strength of the power of minhag, and that's the way it's been throughout the generations. Now we know that there are a whole slew of minhagim that we have. Now we have to understand, first and foremost, what constitutes a minhag? What constitutes a minhag? So we have to realize that basically the way it works is, you have laws in the Torah that's clearly stated in the Psukim, or anything that's referenced even in the Psukim would have the status of a din d'oraisa. That would be a Torah or mandated law. Then you have dinim, many, many dinim, thousands upon thousands of dinim that are found in the Gemara. Okay? And those things which are mentioned in the Gemara, various decrees and various fences that the rabbis placed around mitzvahs in the Torah, dinim derabbanan, right? So they all have the status of halacha. Anything that's mentioned in the Torah or in the Gemara, to the point of the Chasimus HaTalmud, to the point where the end of the Talmudic period, when the Gemara was finally edited at the last generation of Amoraim, of Ravina, Ravashi, and people like that. So at that, anything that's in there has the status of halacha. Any development beyond that cannot have the status of halacha simply because it wasn't mentioned in the Gemara. So therefore, even such things as wearing a yarmulke, Okay, it doesn't say anywhere in the Torah or in the Gemara that a Jew is obligated to go and wear a yarmulke. A Jewish male is obligated to go wear a yarmulke on his head. Okay, nor is it stated anywhere that a Jewish male is obligated to wear a talis cotton, to wear a small talis with four corners and tzitzis under a shirt or over a shirt. Doesn't say that anywhere. Doesn't say that in the Gemara. And certainly it does not say anywhere that a Jew cannot eat kidneys on Pesach, nor does it say that a Jewish male is not allowed to marry more than one wife, nor does it say that any of the more recent practices, wearing a gartel, wearing a strimel, whatever the minhag may be, walking down to the chuppah with your shoelaces untied, right, which some people have that practice, okay, for some Kabbalistic reason. All kinds of, you go in the Sephardic community, there are many, many minhagim wearing a red item to ward off ayin hara. None of this is mentioned, or certainly not mentioned lahalacha. Sometimes you have a reference to it, wearing yarmulke, there's a reference to it in the Gemara, but it was never established as halacha. So all of those things are considered minhag. All of those things are considered minhag. Okay, now as you could realize, some minhagim are stronger than others. In other words, wearing a yarmulke is a minhag that has been accepted by Jewish men for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, if not over 1,000 years. So that perhaps takes on the status of a stronger minhag. For Ashkenazic Jews not to eat kidneys on Pesach is a minhag that goes back at least to the time of the earliest Rishonim, and perhaps earlier. There are sources that trace it even to the period of the Gaonim, even though they were living in the Middle East, but the concept is mentioned in the very, very early, going back 1,000 years, so that has a very strong power to it. Whereas other customs, the custom of waiting till a young boy is 3 years old to cut his hair is something that there really is, that's a much more recent development. And then you have things which people could take upon themselves as personal minhagim, meaning that a person decides that he wants to be machmir, that a person decides that he would like to, even where the halacha may allow certain things. For example, in America, certainly it is widely accepted by most Jews that you don't have to eat something which is strictly labeled as Chol of Yisrael. In other words, that even if it was milk from Publix, as long as it was milk from a cow, which we know that it is for various reasons here in this country, so you could drink it, okay? That's based on heterim that we're given, or psakim, I shouldn't say heterim necessarily, psakim that we, the halachic decisions that were rendered by Rav Moshe Feinstein and the Chazon Ish and other people who said such things, but nevertheless, there are people that want to be strict. So a person can say, well, my minhag is to be careful about Chol of Yisrael. Okay, so that's very nice. But the question is, what status does that have? And is that something that can be imposed by one side on the other? If a boy and a girl are getting married, you say, well, I always have eaten Chol of Yisrael. A friend of mine married a girl from England I don't know for sure, and maybe someone can contradict this, but at least at that time, the laws that exist in this country were not as firmly entrenched in England, and therefore all Jews in England had to drink Chol of Yisrael milk. They had to. They couldn't rely on the heterim that are in place here in the United States. So when he got engaged, he was living in America, so his kala at that time said, I never in my life drank something that wasn't labeled Chol of Yisrael. So how could I do this now? But on the other hand, there is a halachic decision that it would be permissible. So the question is, where does all this fall into place, and how do we handle these types of situations? So basically, it's like this: the first source that discusses this topic is found in the writings of one of the Rishonim. It's on page 3 here. We tried to number the pages, although it's not so clear. Okay, the Tashbats or. Well, Misorah means a tradition. So good. So there could be Misorahs for different things. A lot of times the Misorahs are Minas. Yeah, alright. This is their tradition. This is their tradition. This is the way they do it. In certain places, this is why there's an infinite number of things that fall into that category. Infinite number of things that we're coming. Well, the tradition this now, how long do you wait between milk and meat? Right? The other way. How long do you wait between meat and milk? Right? So that's a question that goes back very far. And you have a lot of discussion about this. So we have in the writings of it really should be pronounced Tashbet, but in the yeshivish circles it's pronounced Tashbats. So anyway, one of the great, written by one of the Rishonim, I believe this man was a Sfardi, but he writes as follows. He writes here in Kuf Ayin Tes. So he says, what do you do in a situation where there are kehilos that have various takonos? Right? Now, he wasn't even speaking about Ashkenazim marrying Sfardim or vice versa. He was speaking about situations where you had just in this town, they had certain policies. The Rav, you know, it used to be that every town had one Rav, or one Chacham, whatever you want to call it. They had one halachic authority, and he set the policy in that town. And maybe they had a Bezdin that was under him, and they got together and they made certain policies, and this is the way it's going to be, and that's what everybody did. You just did whatever back in the day, the rabbonim in the communities before you had telephones, so a rav who was asked to shaila had to be able to field the shaila himself. He couldn't pick up the phone and call a posek because that wasn't possible. So you had rabbonim gedolim in virtually every community. You had people who were poskim and you know, today it's not quite as necessary as it used to be. But so you had takanas, you had certain regulations that were made. So the Tashbats was asked, what happens if somebody marries someone from a different town? And we know that we have an issue of, so now you'll say, well, if someone will ask, why don't we have the question of lo sisko to do? Why don't we once spoke about, why don't we have the fact that you're not supposed to deviate in one town with having people with two different practices? So the answer to that is that in general, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Yevamos that when you have shnei batei din and birachas, if you have in a town two different groups, so then there is no obligation for one to follow. You don't have to have uniform policy. In other words, according to the law of the Torah, if in a town there is one practice that is followed, you're obligated to follow that practice. As the Chazal say, Al Yishana Adam Ipnei Machlokes, the person is not supposed to deviate because it will cause strife, it'll cause dissension, it'll cause fights. As we know that we have that in situations in shuls, my minig is this and my minig is that and so forth. So really, if there's a strong custom in one place, everybody's supposed to do it. However, if it's already accepted that in the town there are two different practices, like what we have here by us, whether it's here in Miami or basically anywhere in Klal Yisrael, is that within the same town you have all kinds of practices, so therefore each one is entitled to follow their own. It could be even in the same shul. We once spoke about that, whether that applies even in one shul, that you could have people following different practices. But certainly, you could have different shuls in the same community, that one follows one follows the other. That would not be a violation of lo sisko to do. That would not be a violation of the prohibition of creating strife in a community. However, what happens if you have a situation where you have a young man from one kehila married someone from a different kehila, and wherever they're going to live, but in that town, there are both practices being followed. So what do? So the Tashbat said, Ein Sofek, this is on the sixth line from the beginning of the paragraph, Ein Sofek, there is no question, he says, Sheha'isha hi nechlelas imbaila b'chol chiyuvim, that the woman is included with her husband in all obligations, meaning that the woman should follow the husband's practice. Why? The ishto kegufo b'chol advarim. Because there is a concept in halacha that says that when a couple gets married, so ishto kegufo, a man's wife is like a part of him. A man's wife is like a part of him. Ishto, his wife, kegufo is like his own guf, is like his own body. His wife is like considered a part of him. And therefore, says the Tashbat, therefore, whatever the practice was in her father's house, wherever she came from, it is not no longer applicable. is no longer applicable. And the Tashbatz proceeds to say, "V'davar zeh milsa d'pshitahi." He says that this is really obvious that something has to be done in this manner. The ein bo safik shlo yu shnayim mesubim al shulchan echad chalukim bisoseim. He says, "But what are you going to do? You're going to have two husband and wife sit down to supper on Pesach, right? The one's Ashkenazi, one's a Sephardi, and she puts down a plate of rice." And one says, "Oh, I can't get near that. I keep that away from me." And the other one says, "No, bring it close to me, you know, and you have to start with separate plates and separate utensils and all kinds of things." So that's obviously not a step in the Shalom Bayis direction. Not the type of thing that's going to foster great, marital harmony. So therefore, says the Tashbaz, it's ridiculous. You can't have this, that a husband and wife are going to follow two different practices. Because it's absurd. It's going to result in a lot of issues. It's going to result in a lot of issues. Okay, and therefore one practice has to be followed. Says the Tashbatz that this would be the husband's practice. Why? Because ishto kegufa. Because a wife is like a part of the husband. Now we have to understand, where do we get that from? Who said that? That a wife is like part of a husband. So if you turn back to the first sheet, this is based on a Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin, which was actually talking about a different topic. But the Gemara tells us here, it's on the bottom of the first sheet, in Sanhedrin Chaf Ches, the Gemara says as follows. The Gemara says, Bo Mine, it's on the top line on the bottom section here. Okay, on the first sheet. Bo Mine, the question was asked, Mahu Sheyoed Adam Be'eshes Chargo. Okay, what is the practice? Can a man go ahead and say testimony for the wife of his stepson? In other words, meaning, let's say a man marries a woman who was previously married, and she has a son from that marriage. So the halacha is, we know that in the laws of testimony, a relative is disqualified. You can't say testimony for a relative, you can't be a dayan on a case for a relative, and so forth. So for a man to go ahead and testify for his wife's son is blocked by the laws of, in the laws of Eidus. That chargo means his wife's son. But now the question is... I'm sorry?
It's just a stepson that's all related.
That's considered, it's considered in the Hilchos Eidus. In Hilchos Eidus, since he is married to the mother of this child, so therefore he cannot testify on the child's behalf. But the question is, what about, can he say testimony for that child's wife? There's that child's wife, okay, so he's married to the mother, but he's married to the mother of the husband, not to the mother of the wife. So it's not his child, and this is, you know, this is not even his wife's child. This is his wife's daughter-in-law. So can he say testimony for such a person? So the Gemara says, Amri, that the Gemara says, so Besura Amri Baal Ki Ishto. Okay? But Pumpadisa Amri Ish Isha Kabaila. So the Gemara says that really, the halacha is he cannot do it. He cannot do it, but he can't do it whether it's for his stepdaughter-in-law or his stepson-in-law. Meaning that had it been his wife's daughter who married, her husband, so that's his wife's daughter's husband. He can't say Eidus for either one of them because of the fact that even though you'll say, but he's not related. What's the psul? Where is the Torah has specific guidelines of Eidus. So where's the connection? The answer is that when you're married, you're considered one unit. And therefore, it's not your wife's child. It's your child also. And in both directions. And therefore, not only is that true, but the person who the child is married to, with the husband and the wife, are considered one unit. So therefore, we don't distinguish and say, well, this is my wife's son, but that's his wife. You know, so what do I have to do with her? The answer is, if she married your wife's son, or if he married your wife's daughter, they're considered one unit. And as one unit, therefore, they're posulators. Okay, the Gemara continues and says, as follows. The Gemara says, Rav Huna Amar Minayin Shehaisha Kebaila. Then the Gemara proceeds to say, how do you know that a wife is considered like her husband? Diksiv, because it says, when the Torah lists off the prohibited marriages in the Parsha of Arayas, in Parshas Achrei Mos, so the Torah says, "Ervas achia avicha lo segale," that you should not loosely translated, that you should not uncover the embarrassment, meaning you should not marry or have a relationship with your father's brother. With your father's brother, what does that mean? El ishto lo sikrav dodoschahi, meaning that you should not marry your father's brother's wife, the Torah says. In other words, an aunt, that type of an aunt, is considered an erva midaraisa. So the Torah says you can't marry her, you can't have a relationship with her. Why? And the pasuk says dodoschahi, because she is your aunt. So the Gemara says, what do you mean she's your aunt? She's not your aunt. V'halo eishes dodohu. In other words, in our terminology, in our loose the way of speaking, we would say, well, she's your aunt, but she's more correctly your uncle's wife. She's not your aunt. Your aunt would be your father's sister or your mother's sister. But your father's brother's wife, which we today call aunt as well, but by strictly speaking, that's not your aunt, that's your uncle's wife. So why does the Torah refer to her as Dodoscha? Says the Gemara, Michlal the Isha Kabaila. From this we derive that in the Torah's view, a woman is considered a part of her husband. And therefore, this woman is your aunt, even though she's not a blood relative of yours. She is merely your uncle's wife. Nevertheless, she is considered a blood relative because once she married your uncle, she's considered like a part of your uncle. This is the Gemara that mentions this klal. Now, you say, so here we have the concept of Isha Kabaila. At the same time, we also have the reverse principle that Baal Ke'ishto, when it came to the laws of Eidos. So when it comes, strictly speaking, to the laws of Eidos, of testimony, this issue looms large, and here we have it in both directions. However, in other areas of Halacha, the Chazal took it more in the sense of, when you go beyond Eidos, the Chazal took it more that a woman is considered a part of her husband. Okay, for example, coming up not that long from now, we have Chanukah. So we know that on Chanukah, the practice is, amongst Ashkenazim, the practice is that we have the Mahadrimin or Mahadrin, that every person in the family lights a menorah. Every person in the family is supposed to light their own, and each one according to the candles of the day, right? You have Neru Chol Echad Ve'echad, and Keneged, you know, the days, and so forth. That's the Ashkenazic practice. So the poskim say that a menorah, therefore, should be lit by every member of the family, except by a wife. The Gemara says that a woman does not need to fulfill this halacha of Neru Chol Echad Ve'echad. So really, every child, again, by Ashkenazim, Sfaradim have a different shita in this because they hold, as we once discussed, that the at the end of the day, just one person, that just the head of the household lights the menorah, but amongst Ashkenazim, that every family member lights a menorah, so every child should really light their own menorah. But nevertheless, the poskim say clearly that when it comes to a husband and a wife, the wife does not need to light. She doesn't need to light. Why not? Because she is yotzei with her husband's lighting, because ishto kagufo, because a man's wife is considered like a part of him, and therefore she did light the menorah. And that's an amazing thing, because the whole takana was neru chol echad. The whole rule was that each person in the family should light their own menorah. So you'll say, so good, so she has to light her own menorah. How do you get around that? The answer is because she did. She did. How did she? Because her husband lit it, and she is considered one unit with her husband. Based on this, the Tashbat says that it's simple, in his opinion, that you cannot have a husband and wife practicing two different halachic practices because it'll lead to a tremendous amount of strife, potentially, and therefore it has to go one way. Ishto kagufo, the wife follows the husband's practice. You could say, what do you mean? But based on the Gemara and Sanhedrin, it goes in both directions. The Gemara doesn't seem to favor one more than the other in the laws of Eidos. But nevertheless, in practice, in other areas of halacha, it comes up in a few places that we say, ishto kagufo, that the wife is like the husband. This is what he said. Okay, now, for some reason, I don't know why, but for some reason, this was not quoted as much. This was not quoted in the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein that he wrote when he was asked this question back in the 1950s. I don't know why he didn't cite this precedent from the Tashbats, but he was asked the same question, and he approached it from a different angle. Now, before we do that, I just want to point out, before we leave the Tashbats, I just want to say one interesting point. The Tashbats then goes ahead and questions What would be in a situation where the husband passes away? In other words, we say that the wife should follow the husband's custom. In other words, in her father's house, they followed practice A. Right? In the father's house, they waited 3 hours between meat and milk. Okay? But her husband waited 6 hours between meat and milk. But now her husband passed away. So now she's on her own. So does she revert back to what her father did, or does she stick with what her husband did? So the Tashbat said very interestingly that this can be considered analogous to the law of Truma, that we find that if a regular Jewish girl, a Bas Yisrael, goes ahead and marries a Kohen, so the halacha is Truma, the special separation that the Torah is very strict about, that has to be presented to a Kohen, right? Roughly 2% of a person's produce has to be given to a Kohen. It can only be eaten by Kohanim. So what happens if a Kohen marries a girl who was not from a Kohen family? So the halacha is that she could eat truma so long as she's married to him. She's considered kinyan kaspa, the various drushes in the Gemara, that she is considered his wife, and therefore she can go ahead and eat truma as well. Now what happens when her husband passes away? So the halacha is depends. If they had no children, so then, basically, her marriage has now ended, so she reverts back to her status that she was before she was married. However, if she has children, so then the halacha is that it's considered, if they had children together, so it's considered that the marriage is still on, and therefore she can go ahead, just like the children can eat truma, because the children are kohanim, because the yichus goes by the father, so the children could eat truma, so the wife could eat truma too. And in the reverse, it would also be so. In other words, if a girl from a Kohen family, a Bas Kohen, married Yisrael, so now she can no longer eat truma. She can't even eat her father's truma, right? If they go for Shabbos to the parents and the father puts out challahs from truma, right, or any such thing, so that they put out food that is from truma, she can't eat it anymore because she's married to a non Kohen. However, that's true only so long as she's married to him. Once the marriage ends, if the husband passes away, so then again, it depends. If there were children, the marriage is still considered going. If not, not. Says the Tashbats, therefore, and he says, in my opinion, it should be the same thing here. That if they had children, so the practice of the husband should still be followed by the wife. Even though she doesn't come personally from such a practice, but that's her husband's practice, and should be continued. However, in a situation where the no longer, where they had no children, then she reverts to her own. This is what he said. Okay, now, Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked this question, as were many contemporary poskim. And yes, go ahead. Tashbats, I believe, was in the 15th century, I believe. 15th century. In other words, this is one of the later Rishonim. And, this is what he said. I don't know, it's not, today it was reprinted in very nicely, in the 3 volumes. It could be it wasn't as accessible back in the day. I don't know, but in the Igros Moshe, you would think he would have quoted this, but he makes no mention of it. But Rav Moshe Feinstein had a different approach, which is in reality followed by a lot of other people, including Rav Avadya Yosef, Zichrono Livracha, just recently passed away, who in his sefer, Yabia Omer, has a long tshuva about this topic, and basically he and Rav Moshe went down the same road, and that is this. We referred to this at the outset of the shir. The Mishnah in Pesachim discusses what happens if a person goes on Erev Pesach from one town to another town, and in his town they did not do work on Erev Pesach at all, and in this the town he went to they do, or vice versa. So the law is complicated, as we will soon see. The law is a little complicated, but basically what comes out is as follows, and this is really the basis for the very relevant contemporary issue of Jews who go to Eretz Yisrael for Yontif. And the question is, should you keep 2 days of Yontif or 1 day of Yontif? Now, bear in mind that the observance of 2 days of Yontif in Chutz La'aretz that we do, that we have Pesach for 8 days instead of 7, and the 7 days of Sukkot become 8, and the day of Shemini Atzeres becomes 2, and so forth, all of those things are really, if you look in the Gemara Maseches Beya, that even though it is mandated by the Gemara that in Chutz La'aretz you have to continue to observe the Sveika Dioma, but the Gemara, the way the Gemara refers to this is Hizaru b'minag avoseichem b'yadeichem. The Gemara says when the question was posed that what today we have a set calendar, so today there is no question. The whole need for the Sveika Dioma was when they were Mekadosh the Chodesh al Piriya, when they would declare the new moon based on observation. But today we don't have that. We have the calendar. So what's the point? We know exactly. We have a mathematical calculation. We know exactly when the Molad is announced in every shul, right? When they bench Rosh Chodesh, right? A week ago Shabbos, it was announced in every shul when the Molad is going to be. So what's the issue? So the Gemara says, Hizaru b'minag avoseichem b'yadeichem, you should continue the practice. Continue that minna, continue that practice. And the Gemara says, because you never know what's going to happen, they could get back into a situation of uncertainty, some things over the course of the Golos, who knows what could happen. So therefore, keep it the way it is. But that largely is rooted in minhag. In other words, even though it's a halacha, it's a halacha. Nobody has the minhag outside of Eretz Yisrael to only keep one day of Yontif. But nevertheless, the yisod of that halacha is in minhag. So this comes up. This is the very big question. What happens if you go to Eretz Yisrael for Yontif? What happens if a person has an apartment in Eretz Yisrael? Or in the reverse, a person in Eretz Yisrael comes to America, or they have a place to stay in America. What do you do in a situation like that? So basically, this is the way it shakes down. It's one sif in the Shulchan Aruch and the laws of Erev Pesach. If you're ever wondering where would you look this up, so the place to look is in the laws of Erev Pesach. There is a sim in Tav Samech Ches which speaks about the law of Erev Pesach, which is the source in the Mishnah. So basically, it's as follows. Okay, so I'm going to read here from the Mishnah Brura because the Shulchan Aruch's ruling is very hard to understand, very ambiguous. So I'm going to read here from the Mishnah Brura, which is printed on the top of page 2. Okay, and he says like this. And the Mishnah Brura says, the Kloel Shel Sivzeh, from the top line. The Mishnah Brura says, I'll give it to you straight. Okay, Lefi Das Magen Avram, Mekam Mefarshim, Shechlitu Kamos Halacha. Here. Kishe'odam Holech Me'iro Le'ir Acheres. If a person travels from his city to another city, Ubi'iro nagu lahakel be'ezer davar, and in his city they were lenient. Ubi'ir sheboba machmirin b'zeh, but in the place that he arrived, they're strict. In other words, in his hometown, they're lenient, but in the place that he arrived, they're very strict. So the halacha is as follows: in ein daito lehishtakeya be'ir azos b'tmidis, if he is not planning on settling here, if he's just here for a visit, and he's going back after a period of time, this is not going to be his residence. He says, "Eino chalol of chumrei makom zeh meikar adin." So really, he does not have to change his practice, because this is not my practice. Where I come from, they don't do this, and I'm still in that place, even though I happen to be here now. But it's temporary. Okay. So he says that therefore, you really meikar adin. You could stick to your own practice. V'yachol lino guhakol kamoso. So in private, you have the right to conduct yourself the way they do it in your place. But in public, you should not deviate. Because if you're going to go publicly and act against the common practice, so people get upset, what are you doing? This is not the way we do it here. People get all offended, right? So you shouldn't do it in the public. But in private, you're not bound by the minhag. So he says, that's only something that can be kept private and so forth. Right? He says, but other things which cannot be kept private, like doing work, then you really would have to, as long as you're in the city, you would have to observe the laws of that city. Okay, now we're going to skip a line. He says, by the period, ubedaito lehishtakeya. However, what if the person is planning on staying here? In other words, he came to this new town and he's planning on settling here. Says the Mishnah Berurah, Chal olav minig hamakom takeh kishabo l'tchum ha'ir. Then as soon as he enters into the environs of the city, if his plan is to stay here, if a man lived for many years in a different city, and now he travels to a new city and he's relocating, and his plan is, that's it, I'm making the move, I'm here for good. So the moment he enters the new city, he is bound by the laws of that city. Whatever practice he had previously is irrelevant. Okay? And that would be true, bein l'kul or bein l'chumer, that would be true whether in his city they were, previous city they were stricter or more lenient, doesn't matter. It's all over now because he's in the new place. So he says that, and that being the case, even if he wants to go outside the town to follow his own practice, he's not allowed to. Because the minhag hamakom has come upon him. Okay, that's basically the way it is. That's basically the way it is. And therefore, it translated into our basic halacha, so we know that if a Jew goes to Eretz Yisrael, if a Jew who lives outside of Eretz Yisrael, lives in the Golos, goes to Eretz Yisrael for Yontif, so you have to keep the 2 days of Yontif. Because of the fact that even though the minhag in Eretz Yisrael universally makes no difference, Ashkenazim, Sephardim, Chassidim, everybody keeps only 1 day of Yontif, but nevertheless, that doesn't help you because you're not here for good, you're just here for a visit. So therefore, all the laws of your hometown still apply to you. So you can't say that, well, everyone else, you know, on the eighth day of Pesach is eating chametz, so I'm going to do that also. You can't do that because back home, they're not eating chametz today. So you're bound by that law. And so too in the reverse. If you have an Israeli who comes to America or anywhere else in the Gola for Yontif, so they have to, so as much as they have, they say, well, where I am, we only keep 1 day of Yontif. Okay, that's great, but that's not where you are now. Right? So, excuse me. In other words, since where I am, they keep 1 day of Yontif. So really, he only has to keep 1 day of Yontif. Right? Even in Chutz La'aretz, because the fact that he's in America doesn't impact on him. However, in public, he can't go ahead and act like a person from Eretz Yisrael, meaning that if he goes to a hotel for Pesach, and somehow, he gets his hands on some chametz on the eighth day of Pesach, and he says, well, there's nothing wrong with me eating chametz because I'm Israeli. So it's not Pesach in Israel today. But nevertheless, if you're in America, you can't publicly deviate from that practice because no one else is eating chametz, so you can't do it either in public. In private, you could do it. But in public, you cannot do it. Okay, this is basically roughly speaking, this is the way it's followed. Now, the questions that come up, obviously, are by people who go for extended periods of time. So what happens if a boy goes to learn yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael for several years? Where does that place him? Or even a girl goes for 1 year to a seminary in Israel or so forth. These types of questions are discussed by the contemporary poskim. And, that's beyond the scope of this year. But the fact of the matter is that's the basic rule. The basic rule is that if you're there for good, then you could abandon everything you did until now. There's no point in keeping it, and the fact of the matter is you're obligated to do as they do in this place. Whereas, if you're just there temporarily, so then you still have the old rules in place. So says Rav Moshe Feinstein, a very interesting approach, that a marriage between a girl from one practice and a boy from a different practice is like the girl, because we find in the Torah several places that she's going into his home, right? It doesn't fly so well in the contemporary, the conventional wisdom of today where everything is supposed to be equal, but the Torah views it, you find in the Sukkim and the Torah, Vishulchami Beiso, right, that is considered the marriage, the home of the marriage is considered the man's house. So says Rav Moshe that therefore it's equivalent to a person who travels from a place where they practice is one way to a place where the practice is another way, and it's permanent. And it's permanent, because when they get married, you can't, even you'll say, well, who says for sure the marriage is permanent? May not, marriages end in divorce too. But that's not something that could just be done like that. She can't just walk away, she at least gonna need a get. So therefore, Rav Moshe said that in his view, this is considered analogous to that case. So she's traveling from a place where the minhag was one way to a place where the minhag is another way, even though she might have married her next door neighbor. You'll say, wait a minute, she didn't move. She moved, one door down. It happens sometimes, right? The girl next door is who the person marries, right? So you'll say, well, what kind of traveling is that? But in halacha, it's conceptually viewed as if she's going into a new place, because she's going into her husband's home, and her husband has a different set of rules. And therefore, because she's going on a permanent basis, the previous practices are no longer relevant. And therefore, on that basis, On that basis, the halacha would be that if a girl from a Ashkenazic family marries a boy from a Sephardic family, even though in her home all the years on Pesach they never ate rice, he'll say, so now this is a very big kula that in her husband's house they do this, but since even Rav Moshe and the others all agree to the principle that even though they don't cite the Tashbats, but at least he doesn't, but nevertheless, the basic concept that you can't have a husband and wife following two different practices, everyone agrees to, that would be a very big strain, potentially a strain on the marriage. So therefore, Rav Moshe said that even though she never ate rice and her parents wouldn't be caught dead eating rice on Pesach, nevertheless, her husband is a Sephardi, she's allowed to eat rice. No problem. And so it would be by any minhag. By any minhag, if a girl from a 6-hour family between meat and milk married someone who waited only 3 hours, or married somebody who waited only 1 hour, she has the right to say that that's it, I am now in a different situation, and even though my father doesn't do this, even though my entire family doesn't do this, but because this is now my situation, I have now traveled, so to speak. I have conceptually traveled mi makom l'makom. So therefore, the halacha is that I take on the practices of my husband and not the practices that I had previously. And this is pretty much the accepted standard by all the contemporary poskim. This is what everybody says. That whether it's because Ishto Kagufo, like the Tashbat said, or whether it's because of this a little bit more broader type of analogy that Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Adi Yosef make, but nevertheless, that is the basic practice. Okay, however, there is one catch. Yeah, go ahead.
Does the husband have any chiyuv on some level to mock herself that his in-laws are coming?
Okay, I'm going to get to that, hopefully. So now like this. So now, however, there are exclusions to this. Yes?
I just wanted to clarify the concept that Mishnah wrote about now, about being in different places.
Yeah.
So we spoke about specifically the example where you just saw where the minhag is held in the Muslim, like the actual land, what if the person was moving in Ashkenazi, was moving into a Scottish community?
Okay, so that's a good question. So the truth of the matter is, just taking this halacha to its fullest extent, you don't need marriage for that. In other words, if an Ashkenazic Jew moved into a Sephardic community, even without marriage, but it was a strictly Sephardic community, he would have to follow the Sephardic practices. Bein l'kula, bein l'chomer, that's true. In other words, the reason I didn't mention that is because it's very rare in our times that should happen, because there's such a bilbul in all the cities that we live in every community, wherever you go, they have Ashkenazim and Sephardim and different shuls, even the smallest Jewish communities nowadays. But someone's just telling me, you know, there's a young man here in the yeshiva who lives in Rochester, New York, which is a nice Jewish community, but not the largest. And already they have a Sephardic shul also. They have an Ashkenazic shul and a Sephardic shul. So in such a place, you have the right to continue your own practice. But theoretically, if a Jew moved into a country or into a city where there is one practice followed, yeah, that's right. Even Ashkenazi would follow a Sephardic minhag and reverse. And change the nusach. Yeah, change the nusach. So that, I think that's Al Titosh Taras Yimecha. Then even if you say, I like the Sephardi minion better because they daven faster or slower, or you get Birchas Kohanim every day, right, which is a nice reason to sometimes go into a Sephardi shul, right, but nevertheless, that's not really called you changing. In other words, but if you're in a place where there's strong minhag hamakom, in that place, which I say, not so easy to find today, then you follow the minhag hamakom. You follow the minhag hamakom, and no matter what, Ashkenazim, Sephardim, Chassidim, makes no difference. If that's what they do, because the overriding principle that the Shulchan Aruch says actually on the sheet there is al yishana adam epnei machlokas. You're not supposed to deviate, because deviation results in fights. That's the way it is. It results in dissension and arguments. Yeah, yes.
Well, let's say I move to Eretz Israel.
Yeah.
And I choose just like in Jerusalem to go to any shul.
You should really stick to your principles. In other words, but again, today, in other words, really, a person who davens strictly the Nusach Ashkenaz should not, don't take us the wrong way, but should not daven in the Sephardic shul and should not daven in the shtivel. Because they don't daven that way in the shul, and you know, at least some of the things you have to, you know, we discussed this once, you know, if you're the shliach tzibur, or if you're saying kaddish in a shul, right, if a person comes in here to the yeshiva, which davens the Nusach Ashkenaz, and wants to say kaddish, which often happens because this is one of the closer minyanim to the airport, and therefore a lot of times by Ma'ariv, we get people who have a chiyuv to come in here daven Ma'ariv, and I've told numerous occasions, I've gone over to the person and said, you want to daven for an amid? No problem, just please, no v'yatzmach b'kanei. We don't say that here. Okay, and almost never do they follow it. Okay, always. It's uncontrollable. Like, mumble it, say it quickly, right? It's just like somehow, but that's wrong. That's wrong. You'll say, what do you mean, but that's the way I do it, and it's such a beautiful tefillah, and the Arizal said this, and who did this one said that. It doesn't matter, because Al Yishana Adam Evnei Machlokes, you're not supposed to deviate, because deviation results in strife. So therefore, you're just not supposed to do it. If you're in a place where they don't say Tachnun on this day, you don't say Tachnun either. Okay? Even if you're trying to make a political statement, or whatever it may be, right? If they don't say Tachnun, you don't say Tachnun. And if they do say Tachnun, you should say, sometimes, if they do something and you don't, it's a little bit better, because not as apparent why you didn't do it. But to actively do something which is against the practice is wrong. It's wrong to do that. So therefore, this is the overriding rule. Now, here's the catch. The catch is, Rav Avadi Yosef in his Svarim, in several places, made a distinction between different types of minhagim. And he said, there are some minhagim that go back generations. Like, for example, the kitnius on Pesach issue. Okay, so that goes back a long way. So that is a firmly entrenched minhag. However, what happens if it doesn't go back generations, but it's simply the husband's practice? Like, for example, as we said originally, the husband has decided that he's going to be strict about Chol Yisrael. That he's only going to eat Chol Yisrael, or Pas Yisrael, or any other such thing where there's different opinions that you could follow. But it's only his practice. It's his practice. It's not a familial thing. That's what he took upon himself. So Rav Ovadia Yosef says clearly, and I believe in the Tshuvas of Rav Moshe Feinstein, you see this also, that in such a situation, it cannot be imposed upon the wife. Meaning, if the husband wants to eat Chol Yisrael and the wife says, I like Hershey's chocolate bars, or I like going to Carvel, so be it. He cannot cite minhag as the basis to stop it. And so too, if the husband takes upon himself that he's going to observe Shabbos for 72 minutes, like the Rabbeinu Tam Shita, that he will not make Havdalah until 72 minutes after, he will not do Malacha on Motzei Shabbos till 72 minutes after this man, and the wife says, it's hard for me to do that, she is not obligated to follow him. And so too, if the husband says, I have a strict shita that I don't rely, for whatever reason, I don't rely on a community Erev, okay, citing certain things, and not because necessarily he doesn't trust the way the Erev was constructed, but because there are various opinions about Erevin and so forth, that he does not have the ability to impose that on his wife, because of the fact that this is not an entrenched minhag. This is his practice. His practice he cannot impose on his wife. And so too we find in the Igros Moshe, there's a tshuva, I didn't put it on the sheet, but it's in the Chelek Evin Ezer, in the second section there, second volume of Evin Ezer, that a man came to Moshe Feinstein and said that where he comes from, his practice is, he's not comfortable with his wife wearing a shetel. He's not comfortable with his wife wearing a shetel. Now, what he meant by that, not that she should go with her hair uncovered, but rather there are people that hold that shetels are not acceptable because of marasayin, because a person will see, especially nowadays, the shetels are made in such a way that you can't distinguish so easily between hair, real hair, and a wig. And the man said that, I hold that it's not good enough, the shetel's not good. I want my wife to dafka wear either a hat or a kerchief or something like that. So Rav Moshe said that he has no right to impose that on his wife, and he said, especially in this case, because he said, this is halacha, it doesn't apply to you. You don't wear shetel. She wears a shetel. So therefore, in that situation, what right do you have to say to her? What right? It's her halacha. It's her halacha. You can't say to her that you can't do that. Yeah, go ahead. I get that. So now, what about, what, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry?
The wife who got the right to say,
should she? So should she? That's between the two of them. That's between the two of them. There has to be, Rav Avad Yosef says clearly that a man has to take into consideration that it may be easier for him than for his wife, and he has no right to impose if it's hard for her, so maybe he shouldn't be such a tzaddik. You know, in other words, you have to know. It depends what it is. Sometimes the husband can say to his wife, you know, I'd really prefer if you did this, but sometimes if he sees that it's hard for her to do it, so he goes so far as to say that maybe he should stop doing it. That he should stop doing it because she's going to feel bad. You do it. She's going to feel guilty that she's not living up to your standard. So if it's reasonable, if her position is reasonable, maybe you shouldn't do it yourself.
Yeah.
So okay, this is already a discussion that takes place in every marriage, which I'm not trying to get involved with. But the fact of the matter is that the principle is there. The principle is there. In other words, the chiluk between a time-honored minhag, in other words, like kidneys, or even on Pesach, sticking to Pesach, eating gebrucht or not gebrucht, which is, you know, an old tradition, which today the point behind it is largely irrelevant as it is with kidneys, but nevertheless, it's minhag avosenu b'yodeinu, we do it the way we used to do it. So there too, that could be a time-honored tradition. But when it comes to personal chumras, or personal anhagas, so that it is reported, I don't know if it's true, but it is reported that this is in print, so I feel comfortable to say it, that Moshe Feinstein himself, that he himself was strict about not eating Chol of Yisrael, and his wife wasn't. Even though he's the author, just for the record, the author of the tshuva that allowed people not to eat Chol of Yisrael, but he himself was strict, according to many people. There's a machlokas about this as well, like there is about everything, even stories we have machlokas, Baruch Hashem, right? But nevertheless, his wife, they say that she said, you know, I don't have to do that, and that was the way it was. And so it is with Shabbos, very common, with Shabbos or other such things, that there is no outright obligation. This is the consensus. The consensus that the ishto kagufo or the holich mimakom wamakom does not apply in those type of situations. Now, finally, when it another situation where this comes up, what happened, a common shiloh in the summertime, that what happens if the husband says, I'm going to 7 o'clock minyan Friday night. Okay, and Shabbos is not till, the real Shabbos, the zman is not till after 8 o'clock. But the husband says, I'm going to early Shabbos. So does the wife have to drop what she's doing to follow him? So in the Igros Moshe, if Moshe Feinstein said, no, she doesn't. She doesn't, because he can't impose Shabbos on her. That's his, he decided that he wants to make Shabbos now for whatever is good for him. Fine. But that does not block her ability to do Malacha. However, he said it could be that something that she's doing for him, she should not do, because since he accepted Shabbos, so therefore she shouldn't do it for him. But if she wants to, whatever, you know, bathe or whatever it may be, which involves doing various malachas, okay, or who knows what, she's allowed to do so. She is not bound by her husband's Kabbalah Shabbos. Okay? So that's how far this goes.
Now, to,
what's that? It certainly applies in reverse. Yeah, she accepts Shabbos. A man could drive to shul after his wife lit candles. That's true as well. Yeah, that is true as well. Now again, you have to know, everyone has to use judgment to know, you know, what works for them. If someone's going to be insulted, so then, yeah, then it changes the whole discussion. But we're talking here strictly from the letter of the law. Alright, just to finish, because we're over the time. Okay, now, in terms of, the question comes up, in a situation of a marriage where the girl is now taking a more lenient practice than she did previously. She used to wait 6 hours, and now she's marrying someone who only waits 3 hours. Does she need to make hataras nedarim? Does she need to go ahead and because we know in halacha that a practice that is carried forth, a good practice 3 times, constitutes a neder, and therefore, since there are certainly opinions that say you should wait 6 hours, that's what the Rambam says in the Shulchan Aruch, so therefore, that's a very nice practice. So does she need to make hataras nedarim? So here, there is again a dispute, but Rav Moshe Feinstein held that a woman does not need to make hataras nedarim. She does not need to make a taras nedarim. She could just switch without anything. Rav Avad Yosef disagreed with that, but I believe the minhag, certainly amongst Ashkenazim, is that people don't make a taras nedarim. And finally, in a situation where people don't have a tradition, Okay, so the question is, what happens if you have a marriage between two people that one of them was observant from birth and comes from a family tradition in that sense, and the other one doesn't? So what do you, and so let's just say that the wife comes from such a family and the husband doesn't. So what do you do in that case? So there are different, here I don't believe there's a consensus. There are different opinions. It really depends on who you ask. Many will say that if there's an entrenched minhag, if it's the wife's minhag, so the husband should follow it. There are others that say that not necessarily, that the husband has the right to say that this is what I followed since I became observant, and this is what we're going to do. This is a serious in the sense that it's not a consensus, so that people really have to see for themselves, to speak to their own rav, to decide what is best for them. Yes?
Just one small little point.
Yes, go ahead.
The word minhag. If you don't follow your minhag, and you take the word minhag backwards, and what do you get?
Ganon. Okay, there you have it. All right. So add a little fuel to the fire. But anyway, if a person has such a question, they're best off speaking to a rav, find out, you know, what they do. But this is essentially the idea of a husband and wife following in husband.